Okay, the question is, what do you think about jhanas? Have you experienced jhana states yourself? So I'm very sorry to disappoint you, but I'm not allowed to answer part B because it's part of our rules that we don't talk about that. Isn't that unfortunate? And the reason for that is very beautiful, because the Buddha wanted to keep us very honest, and he wanted to keep any kind of competition and, could we call it, jhanocracy out of the Sangha. Does that make sense? So the problem with monastics starting to announce attainments, because jhanas are understood to be superior human states, or let's say states beyond the ordinary human realm, is that people can overestimate or they can get very eager to attain these things, and then they can misuse, either they can exaggerate on purpose or mistakenly, which is really dangerous, or they can even do that in order to get more support. And unfortunately, we see this in many countries. Right now in Sri Lanka, there are at least one or two famous monks who go around saying that they're fully enlightened. They call themselves arahats, which means that they've completely destroyed greed, hate and delusion, in which case they wouldn't conceive themselves to be anything at all. And they certainly wouldn't have any wish to impress or any kind of sense of conceit. So in the Buddha's day, there were these two monks that came to the Buddha, obviously after very deep meditation and a lot of wisdom, and probably some deep experiences of non-self. And they came to the Buddha and they both said, separately, at a similar time, they said, one who is fully enlightened never thinks they're the same, better or worse than anybody else. And both of them said this, and that was their way of telling the Buddha what they'd understood. They weren't framing it in terms of, I am a such and such, or I have a such and such. They were just expressing an understanding. So I can express an understanding about jhanas to the best of my ability right now. What do I think about them? They're states without thought. That's one of the characteristics of the jhanas. So in the Visuddhimagga, there are considered to be five jhana factors. So there are five things that together comprise a jhana, or could comprise a jhana. But these factors are also found in deep samadhi before jhana as well. But just to give you an idea and to clarify the difference there, these are what we call vitakka and vichara, which means a kind of directed attention and sustained attention. So it means the attention that is directed towards a particular object. So for example, in breath meditation, the quality of the mind that would keep on pointing the mind to the breath, pointing it to the breath. You might lose the breath, but it would come back again and point to the breath. And then the vichara, the sustained attention, would be the ability to keep the mind with the breath, to be continuously aware of the breath for some length of time. So in the Visuddhimagga, I think they describe the vitakka like the kind of initial strike of the gong, and the vichara like the ring. So you meet the breath and then stay with the breath. In metta meditation, that might be the phrase and then the feeling that ensues from that phrase. So the continuous awareness of the metta, of the loving kindness. And then the next thing that arises from this sustaining of attention is piti. So this is the third jhana factor, which is a kind of rapture that's born from sustained attention. The mind is becoming happy and delighted. I think some of you have talked about feeling some joy and gladness arising. And that's because the mind is staying with the meditation and starting to settle and starting to feel a sense of relief that the hindrances aren't constantly jeopardizing or kind of sabotaging your mind. There's a kind of settling there and a happiness that arises. Also because there's a lot more energy coming into the mind. Yeah, so the gladness, the piti or rapture, and the energy start to arise together, and that increases mindfulness. So your mind is getting clearer, brighter, stronger, and more powerful. And vitakka vichara Piti, and then Sukha, which is a deepening of that rapture into what I would call something like contented pleasure, like kind of pleasure or happiness of contentment that comes from inside the mind. And it's becoming less and less embodied at this time. It's becoming more and more of a mental experience. It's not depending on the body or even on the object necessarily anymore. And it becomes so strong that it kind of becomes a main object of the mind. And that is the proximate cause for the jhanas. So the next jhana factor is ekagata, which means something like oneness of mind. Sometimes they call it one-pointedness, but you're not really pointing the mind anymore. It's more like the object and the mind are merging with each other. So there's very little perception of object and subject anymore. The two are becoming one. Ajahn Brahm sometimes translates that as one peakedness of mind, because the mind is kind of reaching its peak in terms of mindfulness, happiness, bliss, and basically settling, so that your entire perception is full of the object sometimes at that time, but usually just the sukha, the bliss itself. And these five together can comprise a jhana. However, these factors in and of themselves separately are not the jhanas. Some people dilute these things and they say that once you feel piti, then that's the first jhana, then you feel a kind of sukha and that's kind of like the second jhana. Actually, I think they just say that vitaka and vichara is already the first jhana. I'm not quite sure because I don't follow those teachers. But my understanding is that in the jhana states, for something to actually comprise a jhana, vitaka and vichara are not thought. In other contexts in the suttas, vitaka and vichara are considered to be like applied and sustained thought. But actually, the kind of jhanas, as I understand, are beyond thinking. In fact, the mind is incredibly still, incredibly powerful, and it dropped thought a long, long time ago. So, what do I think about them? I don't think too much about them. I think they're things that we will naturally pass through at some point in the path if we're practicing properly. And it's better to experience these things as part of the gradual training than see them as states to attain. It's much more beautiful to cultivate every factor of the path so that when samasamadhi, the jhanas, arise or are revealed to the mind, they are empowered by right view. They have plenty of right intention there. They're born of letting go, not of attaining, not of grasping or trying to gain these states, which can be done through an act of will sometimes. I'm not quite sure it's the real thing, but I have met people who seem to have forced their way in through an act of will, but it doesn't give rise to wisdom that it should give rise to, because there's too much sense of self there. So they're part of the path. They will happen when the causes are in place. Don't strive for them. Remember, they're born of letting go, and just focus on cultivating every path factor. At different times in your life, you can give emphasis to different factors. When you're at work, you can give more importance to right livelihood, right intention, right attitude, right thought maybe, right speech. Yeah, not so much right samadhi at that time, unless you're really absorbed in your kind of computer work, or maybe if you have a manual work, actually, sometimes you can get quite focused, but it won't be sama samadhi. The sama samadhi that the Buddha talked about was, something that arises through the meditation, through letting go in practice. Yeah? Is that okay? There's probably plenty about jhanas, I think. And yeah, good teachers often don't confirm. People have this idea that you get it confirmed by a teacher, but good teachers often don't do that, actually, especially with the first jhana. There's kind of quite a variation in how that might present, and so a lot of teachers will sort of say, yeah, maybe, maybe not, carry on, basically. By the second jhana, it's more stable. There's really no wobbling anymore, no kind of uncertainty there. It's rock solid. How are you feeling today? Oh, is it a good day to be a teacher, Ajahn, today? Oh, that's so sweet. Thank you very much. I don't know if you've heard my previous talk. Sometimes I remember saying during COVID, no one ever asked me how I was. There was no one there to ask me. That's really sweet that you care. And yes, it is a good day. I don't know if it's to be a teacher or to be in a teaching role, because I try not to identify. That's why I don't usually use the word Ajahn, actually, because I feel it's a little bit like, I am a teacher. But I just thought, well, to most people, it sort of represents how long someone's been in robes, so it's probably a good thing to represent the Bhikkhuni Sangha and to show we do have senior nuns. But I try and think of myself more as a spiritual friend, a Kalyanamitta, somebody who hopefully can bring some inspiration, hopefully, and some enthusiasm to learn more about the Buddha's path. And to be able to practice with you all, it's a real privilege. So yeah, it's a great day. I must say, after the morning talk, I felt pretty exhausted, so I had a little rest for about almost an hour, actually. I pretty much drifted off, and then I felt really fresh. So it was a lovely day to be in this role and to be here with you all, especially because it's International Women's Day. And I've never in my life on International Women's Day received a bunch of flowers or been in a place where I felt that, you know, women were actually celebrated in a way that feels incredibly natural, not like, oh, we should, you know, or like, oh, I don't know, it's something special to do that, just normal to do that, to recognize one another's contributions, one another's beauty and strength. So, honestly, really touching today. Thank you for your question. Ooh. Two questions. I'm not as bad as Ajahn Brahm. He'd have only done one by now. Or half a one. Okay. And my clock has 5 minutes less, so don't worry. We'll get enough time. Conceptual approaches to metta are very hard for me. For example, the practice that we did today to imagine the different parts of ourselves. It has been like this for me for the last 15 years. However, I found ways to approach metta. For example, imagining I touch myself or other people who are the object of meditation. Is there a list of such tips and tricks that one could try out if the more narrative approaches to metta are very difficult? I think you are creating the list. You know, you are tailor-making your own practice, and that's a sign of maturity in practice. You try various things, you find out if they fit. I would say don't dismiss them forever, because our mind changes all the time. We were talking about neuroplasticity earlier and how the brain is not fixed, it's malleable, it changes. And one thing that works now or doesn't work now might work later or not. If it's been like that for 15 years, it might be that you're just more of a feeling kind of person. You know? And so am I, actually. I mean, I find the phrases helpful to get things going, because I think I've created quite a strong association with the phrases that my mind knows, oh, she's doing metta, great. And so it kind of goes with a particular formulation of phrases that I've developed over time and that have a nice association for me. But really, I get into the feeling of it quite fast. And then the words drop away pretty fast. Not too fast. I kind of let them simplify. So sometimes, because sometimes you can drop them when the PT starts to come, because you think, oh, now I can go with the PT. But actually the cause of the PT is the sustained attention on the phrases or on something that anchors the mind. So then the PT might start to fade. So then don't drop them too quickly, but you can broaden the gaps, or you can drop down to a single word, like instead of may I be happy, you can just say happy, and that starts to have a feeling. It has a quality associated with it that you can feel in the body and gives rise to the emotion. If you're finding a practice that involves imagining touching yourself or other people, it's probably like a gesture that means loving kindness to you. I've read that in the Christian tradition they have all kinds of devotional practices that involve like loads of different things, actually. If you ever get the chance, there's a book called Sadhana by Anthony de Mello. I don't know if it's... Yeah, you've heard of it. Amazing.
Read it.
Yeah, isn't it wonderful? And it's got loads and loads of practices. And he actually developed this, not because the practices were particularly well known in the tradition, but because there weren't. And many Christian priests even didn't know how to pray. They weren't getting much success. And it's a wonderful book because it has a whole chapter on awareness, and it's obvious he's been on Goenka retreats because I've done plenty myself. So I know that he's using some of those methods. And then there's a chapter on, so there's awareness, and then there's another one, and then there's devotion. What's the middle one? I forget. It might be joy or something like that. Happiness. And it's got so many, sorry?
Happiness.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah. It's just got so many practices, and one of the things they do is imagining just opening themselves to God. I mean, it's different because we don't have a God there that we're opening to, but they might like hold their hands out like this because it symbolizes a kind of surrender or a kind of giving. And maybe it's similar for you with the idea of touch. I mean, really, the practice is anything that works to cultivate wholesome states. So feel really free to create. Yeah. But just be aware that in loving kindness, as in any practice, there are some impurities that can creep in. So one of them, the far enemy, the opposite, in other words, of loving kindness is the anger and the ill will. And it's okay when that comes up because it just shows that, you know, there's something that is beyond the range of your metta right now, and it's showing you the obstacles to metta and the purpose of metta, actually, eventually. You know? But the nearer enemy, what they call the near enemy, is a kind of, well, sometimes people say it's lust, but it's any kind of attachment, clinging, stickiness, sentimental kind of attachment. So just be careful with that if you are imagining touch and maybe, you know, physical contact. See if you can be sure that you're doing it to somebody you don't have, like, romantic feelings towards. Yeah. So, no, there's not really a list. I mean, you have to read a lot and listen to lots of different teachers and also make your own. Sorry. Maybe that's disappointing. I don't know.
Nina Mel changed after he went to a Goenka.
Yeah, that's right.
Because of the change in his perceptions.
Right. And he came to the end of his life and he pretty much realized that these meditative states are not religious. In fact, they're not related necessarily to a god. I think in that book also he said that he had a friend who used to get into the same kind of union with God, is how they called it, just through saying 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4. So you didn't have to use the word of God. It was just that for Christians who have a lot of devotion in God, that was meaningful for them. So only use words that are meaningful for you, because otherwise it's just some kind of blind belief. Buddhists can have blind belief as well. So, yeah, you have to understand the purpose.
He was a Jesuit priest.
That's right,
and
yeah.
A Jesuit priest, and after he died, 3 years after he died, he was excommunicated.
Yeah, after he died. Like to make a point.
Or giving the wrong idea about God and meditation.
Sometimes I think that people that are excommunicated are well worth listening to. It's cool being a bhikkhuni because we're already not sort of not part of the Thai forest sangha. So we're already kind of... It leaves us very free, actually, to relate more to the Buddha's own advice and to find our way to practice that's resonant with the local culture and environment that's in line with the early Buddhist texts. So it's really nice. It's spacious once you find a space to stand. All right, I'm going to keep going with these questions so we do get through. When I try to wish someone happiness, health and peace, I actually end up worrying about my metta object that they're unhappy, sick and troubled in reality. Because of this, I get sad and anxious when I try to do metta practice. How do I overcome this worry and melancholy that it causes? Yeah, this is something that came up in a metta retreat I taught in America. It's good, isn't it, to know that these things are common. I actually had a little list. I think I've got it somewhere in one of my books. A little list of all the different obstacles that we collected that people had. And one of them was worry. It's another impurity of metta. It's a little bit close to the sentimental attachment. You start to actually get too identified with the person and too attached to results. So one way to... I mean, it's okay. All of it is good because you're seeing, again, where metta starts to change into something else. And if you remember at the beginning of today, I said that there are many kinds of love. And what we're trying to do with metta meditation is, in a sense, refine the love, elevate it, purify it, and then extend it to all beings. Yeah? Yeah? So you have some love there, but it's also tinged with attachment, with worry. We're conditioned in our culture that worry means love, to think that worry means love. My mum, I think, used to think that if I'm not worrying about her or concerned, that I don't care. And the same towards me, that the amount she worried showed how much she loved me. But for me, that felt quite pressurizing, actually, because, you know, I wanted to be free to make mistakes. I wanted to be free to sometimes, yeah, not call, you know. And I mean, I know it must be really hard to be a mother, and I can't honestly say I understand, because I'm not a mother in this life. But what I did notice is that when I met Ajahn Brahm, and I received a love that I would call the closest thing to unconditional love, if not unconditional love itself, one of the extraordinary qualities of that is that he never worries about me. And he's told me that many, many times. It's one of the expressions, I think, of his trust and his love and his respect. I can go to him in a real state, you know, anxiety attacks, worried that the project's collapsing, because it has been really tough in the last 9 years at times. And I've just said to him, look, Ajahn, don't you think it's not working? Can't you see that I'm just not coping? And he just sits there and he says, with kindness, I'm not worried about you. I'm not worried. You'll be fine. And sometimes it's always been like, but you should be worried, you know? If you care for me, you should be worried. Why aren't you worried? And he just refuses to buy into that. He just says, I'm not worried about you. And afterwards I was like, oh, hang on, if he's not worried about me, then maybe I'm okay. Like, maybe I don't need to worry about myself either. Maybe this is normal, to feel despair sometimes, to feel anxious sometimes. And that's been incredibly healing to me over time and enabled me to embrace so many more extreme emotions than I've ever had before I did something this hard. And not see that as a sign that I'm somehow regressing, but a sign that the challenges are harder. And yet still I can continue. And still he trusts in me. So the worry, it's a habit and it's okay, but just notice it. The other thing I would say here is that it's important to remember that when you're wishing someone happiness, health and peace, you're not doing it so that they're happy, healthy and peaceful. It's not about them. That might sound strange, but we're actually practicing loving kindness to purify our heart from ill will. Right? The goal is actually our own liberation of mind. In one of the suttas in the Digha Nikaya, I think it's the Sangiti Sutta, and I don't remember where it is, which number, it says something like, the escape from ill will is the liberation of mind by loving kindness, metta ceto vimutti. And that's why we practice metta. So that's why these things come up, because, you know, you're still working through them. So it's not actually that you're trying to make this person happy. That person, you love them whether they're happy, whether they're sad, whether they're sick, whether they're suffering, troubled, whatever it is. You just wish them well. Understanding your wishes for them are good for you, good for the person, but they cannot change a person's destiny, so to speak. They can't actually, you know, bring about a particular feeling for that person. So yeah, don't worry about that. It will come up and it won't be there every time. So don't cling to that either. Don't presume it's going to be there next time in your meditation. And maybe try a different object also. Maybe try someone else that you're less likely to have worry about. It might be that that person's a bit too close to you in your life. One of the most successful people I chose, or like let's say objects that brought success in metta meditation, was a person who'd sponsored a retreat that she sent me on, and I actually practiced loving kindness to her for the entire retreat. I just chose one love person, plus a superpower love person, which was my first preceptor, Sayadaw Upanyajota, for when it got a bit, you know, rote. But for the whole retreat, I had her face kind of in front of me, and I had all this loving kindness, which was so easy, and she wasn't that close. And that was actually quite a good choice for me. So maybe try another person. That might also help. Okay. Why are 8 precept followers and monastics not allowed to eat after solar noon? Is it to help meditation, or is there some deeper teaching included in the practice? Okay, so first of all, often people think that these things are things that don't allow us to do this or do allow us to do that. We take these on upon ourselves. We choose to take these on. So we're not allowed. We choose not to eat after 12. That's the important thing here, first of all. And usually that choice is only possible if we understand its potential benefits. So it's a good to ask about that. I would say yes, it's to help meditation. If you don't have a sickness that's going to make it really hard to do. If you actually have some kind of sickness, like I do, I have a really chronic gastric condition, then I have to take a few oats in the evening, and I consider that completely okay, and the Sangha agrees, because it's actually helping my meditation too. It's helping me be healthy enough to maintain my body so I can practice. But if you are quite healthy and you're not actually hungry at that time, and it's not that difficult to skip a meal, then that little bit of extra restraint is good for the practice. So the last three precepts, the abstaining from eating, the sleeping not on high and luxurious beds, and the abstinence from music and shows and jewellery and perfumes, etc., is basically to quieten down the senses a little bit more and help you turn inside. It's to encourage wakefulness. Like in Burma, we just slept on not even a mattress. It was like a tatami mat, very, very thin on the floor. And I don't think we had a pillow. I'm not quite sure what our heads were on. It wasn't a wooden block. I've had a wooden block in Thailand, which was horrible. It's like literally a wooden block. Anyway, I think people get used to it. But one of the things I noticed is that you really want to get up. So that's how it encourages wakefulness. You don't want to like turn over and have a snooze, you know, on your wooden block particularly. I actually couldn't move my hip at one point. It would get stuck and I'd have to literally lift it up. So that wasn't so good for me. And then eventually I managed to get a spongy thing to sleep on, which was really hot. So yeah, you can try it out in your next retreat and you can find out. But it's not that it goes super much deeper. It's not that it's some kind of ritual that's going to give you, you know, much faster success in meditation. It depends on the person, you know. You might be able to find that just the right amount of food and sleep and everything really works for you. But basically it's more to do with the qualities that you develop. There are many lay people who never take 8 precepts and they can still go all the way to stream winning. So, yeah, these things are kind of optional extras that might give you that little bit more restraint and simplicity that will help your practice. Is this okay? Mm-hmm. This much detail is about okay. Ooh, this is in Finnish. I love it. I just want to try and read the first. Miski kissiminen. Does that mean anything?
Do you want me to try?
Yes, I do, but I just wanted to see if my pronunciation was any good. Do you know what that means?
Miksi kissiminen.
Miksi kissiminen. No, oh, sorry.
Let's
I failed.
Find out.
You could read it in Finnish, perhaps.
Yeah.
People who understand.
Okay. In Finnish first. Miksi kysyminen tai avun pyytäminen on niin vaikeaa? Näyttäisi siltä, että työelämässä pärjäävät vain he, jotka jo tietävät... No, hetkinen. Tuossa on joku sana. Tietävät kaiken ja muut ovat palvelijoita kautta orjia. Tietävät valta.
It's kind of hard even for me.
Yeah.
I can't, but I'll try to.
If anyone isn't shy to say it out in Finnish.
But maybe I can show.
Person who.
Santtu, would you like to come and
see what this is. A word that I don't.
Oh, there's a word you don't.
I can't see it. Maybe you, your eyesight is better. Yeah, but.
Might be, yeah.
Okay. Pärjäävät he, vain he, jotka tietävät kaiken. Tuossa on joku sana.
Vain jotka tietävät kaiken. No, se on, joo. Hard to guess.
I guess it makes sense without that.
Makes sense without the word. So okay. So the question is, why is asking for help so hard?
Right.
Why it looks like that in the working life, like professional life, only those people do well who already know everything, and all the others are servants or slaves. Yeah, that's the question without this one word, but it makes sense like that.
Wow, I guess that's why asking for help is so important. We don't want that sort of society, right, where people pretend to know things and everyone else just follows. It's so dangerous, isn't it? So dangerous, you know, when we assume we know everything. People who think they know everything usually really don't know much. And if we find ourselves thinking we know everything, it's a real kind of red flag, I think, for us. You know, one of the qualities of somebody walking on the path is that the further they go, the more they realize they don't know. The more deluded they realize they are. And so it's so important in the Sangha, the way the Buddha developed the Sangha, the monastic Sangha, to have feedback and input from our peers, you know, to keep each other in check, to be able to receive feedback. That's one of the most fundamental qualities that somebody needs to take up the monastic training. If they can't receive feedback, if they become angry or hostile or basically retaliate with their own feedback before they've really listened to you, then they're considered not fit for the training. So it's so important to be able to ask for help, receive help, give advice, give tips, collaborate together. And I would just say it's a sign that our culture hasn't really understood what true democracy and cooperation looks like, if that's the case in some workplaces. Hopefully not in every workplace, but if that's the ethos in yours, then I don't know. Sometimes it's okay to stay there, and if you can keep your integrity, if you feel you can have an honest livelihood, if you feel you can talk, at least talk to some of the people, but sometimes it's too difficult. There's also a situation where you can be the one to make the change if you're in a position to do so. You can actually model something different, and then maybe other people can follow on. But it depends how ingrained this is, I think. I mean, it sounds really unhealthy if everybody else just follows like slaves, you know. It sounds quite exploitative, and unless you've got very, very ethical leaders, you could find yourself doing something you don't really want to do. That's why they say they don't pay you for nothing, right? Sometimes you have to do things you don't want to do. So if it comes to that and you have to, you know, I don't know, be the cause for somebody being sacked and have to tell them in a very hurtful way, then see if you can do it differently. I don't know. As for the why, I don't know really. I guess people are insecure, people are fearful, you know, so they feel they need to control others. But I hope that you can either thrive there and slowly make some changes, or maybe find another situation if at all possible. Does that make any sense? Anyone else want to say something about this?
I think it's part of our Finnish culture, the not asking for help.
Yeah.
We have this ethos, there is this word called sisu.
Oh.
That means this kind of stamina, that I'm persisting and I'm not going to give up.
And yeah.
Sisu goes through a stone.
Right. You know, mm-hmm.
Stony wall.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
I think in Finland, that's part. I have some Asian friends, and they are saying to me that since they live in Finland, it's way harder to ask for help.
No one does it. Yeah.
So I think part of it is in our culture somehow.
Yeah, it might be.
It's completely untrue. Things are most helpful.
The thing is, they don't want to ask for help for themselves.
But it's good to see that, you know, sometimes we don't want to ask because we're also conditioned that way. But actually, people sometimes really want to be asked. So if you can't do it for yourself, do it for the people that really want to be able to help you. Because actually, it's really lovely to have the opportunity to help a person. I love being asked for help sometimes, not all day, I must admit. But I've had to learn to ask for help in this project, and I could see that it was difficult at first, because I think for me it wasn't so much that it was weakness to ask for help, but I kind of didn't want to bother anyone. And I must have had some sort of view that I should be strong enough to do it on my own. It's a should, isn't it? You know, or that I need to do it on my own because people, I don't want to demand too much, even that I don't feel worth asking. Like, I don't know if what I'm doing is important enough to, you know, require somebody else's help. I don't want to, like, waste their time. Does this ring true for anyone else? Something like that. And then I started realizing, actually, by asking for help, you're giving a person an opportunity to give. Mm-hmm. And they might really want to do that. And they might want to feel valued and feel that you need them, rather than acting as though you can do everything for yourself. And once I started doing that and realising it was actually quite lovely for both people and I could rely on actually someone offering the help that I need, I realised, wow, this is really important to building community, and I've become more and more able to ask for help. Yeah. And receive offers of help, like people getting me a flask full of water before I say, no, it's okay, I'll do it myself, I'm fine, you know. And I can do it myself, it's, you know, I don't need someone to put a flask of water, I just have to remember to bring it. But it's really lovely when it happens. And, you know, the person offering me the flask, I think, feels good about it too, right? Yeah. So we don't have to go along with cultural expectations. This is another one in Finnish, actually.
Is it the same thing about the eating after 12?
I'm not sure. If it is, then I think I've answered it, so... But it can always be a slightly different.
It's a slightly different. Yeah. It has. Should I read it firstly in Finnish and then
as you like?
If it's mine.
Yeah, read it in Finnish, I guess.
I read it Finnish and then I translate it. Kiitos, jos selvennät tätä, olemme syömättä kello 12 eteenpäin. Ja kuitenkin voi syödä suklaata ja kovaa juustoa. Mikä juttu tämä on? Eihän se ole pidättäytymistä tai paastoa. So, it is a slightly different angle. Please, if you could make more clear about this rule of not eating from noon on. And still, you can eat chocolate and hot cheese. What is this thing? That isn't... restriction or fasting, renunciation or fasting.
Right.
Yeah.
I've been asked this question 3 times in the last week, by the way. But it's okay. It's really important. It's really important. Yeah, Ajahn Brahm always says, you know, because I guess all monastics get asked it. He always says it's more important to think about what comes out of your mouth than what goes into your mouth. Which is a nice response in a way, if you're getting too hung up on food. But I mean, yeah. The main reason for this is not because we're trying to do a fast. It's not intermittent fasting. It's not any of that. It's basically for the monastics and for the lifestyle in the Buddha's day. So what actually happened in the stories that are told is that monastics live on alms. They live on the charity of others. I'm a senior nun, so I'm taking the liberty not to bring my bowl with me. But generally speaking, I would have my bowl, which is an alms bowl, and it's a bit too heavy to bring. And in ancient India, I would have gone on alms round every day and received whatever people put into my bowl. So some of the scallywag monks, it doesn't say nuns, sorry guys, just so happens it was monks, they went out in the dark at about 8 o'clock at night and they went on alms round and they really freaked out this woman in the village who thought she'd seen a ghost. And she, when she realised it was a monk, she said, "What are they doing?" She complained to the Buddha, "What are they doing asking for food at this late time of night? It's really scary. They gave me a fright." And because of that, the Buddha said, "Only go on alms round in the daytime. And furthermore, it's good for your health." And I think that was slightly based on the understanding of the body in the, at that time, and also in Indian medicine. I've studied Indian medicine at my degree level. And that was what I did between ordaining the first and second time. And your digestion is at its strongest between 10 and 2 p.m. And I guess solar noon time was a time that was obvious because they didn't have watchers, right? So they just see that the sun was in the sky. I don't think it was like bang on 12 and that if it was 3 minutes after 12, they wouldn't eat. It was not so rigid. It was like, the sun's in the sky, it's kind of at its peak, it's time to eat, right? So there was enough time to walk there was enough time to get back to wherever they would meditate for the rest of the day. And they didn't need more food than that because they would meditate all evening and all night, or most of the night. So this is why. The thing about cheese and chocolate just came later, believe it or not, I think, in the Thai forest tradition. So I guess there's some things there that we still accept. But, I mean, because of my gastric condition, at times I found it really ridiculous that people are allowed to have that, and yet some people criticise me for eating a very small quantity of oats. Because oats are cheap, oats are healthy, chocolate and cheese are expensive, and very fattening, and also full of sugar. So, but basically they kind of made the argument that in the Buddha's day you could have some kind of carob bean and you could have some kind of ghee and sort of honey, and so, well, you know, ghee is a bit like cheese and carob's a bit like chocolate plus honey type of thing. Carob bean plus honey. And then they decided that's what we'll have. So I don't know who decided that, but it stuck. So that's why we have a little bit of chocolate and cheese. I think the actual reason now is just that people feel a bit hungry and a bit weak, maybe, and it gives them a quick lift. It's fat, it's sugar, it's a quick energy boost. But yeah, it depends on the monastery. You know, some places are stricter and they say you can only have that if you're sick. And I mean, if you're sick, do you really want that anyway? So yeah, it got to the point in our monastery at one point where people were coming for the first time and they'd open the cupboard, see like 10 bars of chocolate and put everything on the table. And I was like, whoa, this is not the point, you know, to have like a platter of cheese and chocolate every night. So, yeah, then it loses its purpose of restraint. Hopefully that's enough. In other monasteries, they have other things that they sort of decide are allowable. So in a way, every monastery makes its own decisions, and that's quite important. And that is why Ajahn Brahm and his Sangha in his monastery could make a democratic decision to approve and support the bhikkhuni ordination, because every sangha is supposed to be independent. So that means every community makes its decisions on it based on its own the shared wisdom in that place. And that would also mean that the way each monastery runs would be according to the support system, the town, the place, the people, the amount of support available, etc. So it would keep the monastery very in harmony with the people supporting, which makes a lot of sense. It doesn't make much sense to kind of try and adopt a Thai model here, where when in Thailand, you know, they can just sleep on a platform because it's hot. And you can't do that here, right? Similarly, it doesn't make much sense for bhikkhunis to adopt a traditionally male model and way of doing things, you know, because we're different. Women lead things differently. We need to find our own models. And I just think every place should have its own flavour. It's natural to have its own flavour because it's not actually rules. They're guidelines, they're trainings, they're not really fixed. We're going to be more or less on time. In metta meditation, I found quite a peaceful state of mind. But I feel somehow empty inside, like there's something locked in my heart and I can't open it. My fern doesn't open. How many ferns open in one day? If you see a little fern in the nature and it's like curled up for a day, do you think, oh my goodness, it's never going to open? No. I've only been here a day. This is all very good. So it's great that there's something locked there. It's not actually locked there. What it means is there's more yet to come. So that's wonderful. Your fern will open, but you've got to be kind. Can you advise how to be with this and how to proceed in practice? You don't proceed, you go in. Ajahn Brahm always says it's not progress, it's ingress. So you just keep shining the sun on that little fern. You just stay with that feeling and even give metta to the feeling. Not so that it opens, but just because you care. You just want to explore. It's curious. This is interesting. How does it feel, this peace, but this sense that there's something locked? And just be incredibly patient. I haven't really talked about patience yet, but patience is a really important quality of love. Love gives rise to patience. If you think of the love of a mother for a child, it really nurtures an incredible amount of patience. You know, because you love this child, this being unconditionally, you have this feeling to protect their life. You know, it's your responsibility to nurture and protect. You can be patient with its growing up, with its tantrums, his or her tantrums. You know, you can just accept, oh, this child's just going through a time like this right now, but in the end it'll come right. So you don't expect the child to grow up in a single day. Why should you expect your fern to open up in a single day? And patience is also important in practice, in all kinds of practice. In fact, the Buddha said it's the highest spiritual quality because it gives things time to grow. Everybody's practice grows in different times and also in different ways. Some people feel a lot of bliss, but very rarely the peace. Some people feel the peace, but not necessarily the gushing feeling. Some people do the phrases and connect with the words, but don't necessarily feel the emotion straight away. Other people, everybody's so unique and it changes from time to time because this is just nature happening. So your fern does open, but it doesn't get wrenched open. If you try and pull it open, it breaks. So please don't do that. Just hover around that area where there's a feeling of emptiness or whatever and just continue. Just continue being really kind, maybe even more gentle. Get even closer to that feeling with more curiosity. Thank you, Ajahn Chanda. So grateful to be here and to have you here. Thank you. Lots of little hearts. And I think your fern is beautiful, all curled up, peacefully curled. Just embrace it like that. Sounds beautiful. All right. Often, parts of me tense up and resist even the gentlest phrases of metta or allowing, welcoming experience. Only movement practice seems to ease it most of the time. And continuing sitting still makes the nervous system very dysregulated. Any thoughts or recommendations? There are obvious things to say, aren't there? One is that you could do a lot more walking meditation, or you could just sit for short periods, or you could maybe... Is it possible to bring in a really comfy chair into here, or just get something to lie down on? That might really help. I would also say if you're encountering resistance with the gentlest of phrases, then you've got to get much gentler still. Also with the allowing and welcoming, and also be gentle to the resistance. So remember, it's not only the actual cultivation of love, it's developing love as a way of relating to whatever arises. So at this time, if the resistance is the most obvious thing in your mind, it's the most... It's the thing most desiring and in need of your attention and care, then please be with the resistance in a very gentle way. And maybe even drop the phrases. Yeah, that's okay. So yeah, movement practice is one thing. And easing it is fine, but we also have to learn to just be able to sit with it a little bit, bit by bit, so that we can start to explore it. It's another fern that's maybe closed at the moment and we don't want to go too close to, but maybe it can start to open if we can just stay with it kindly. Yeah, but just respect your own body in practice. And as I say, none of these meditations are commands. It's not even that you have to be here. Maybe we should have said that yesterday. The schedule is entirely optional. How would you introduce metta practice to a 12-year-old pre-teenager who's getting through a lot of... getting through a lot of suffering and feels a lot of anxiety, also self-hate in her life. Oh, it's so hard being a teenager. She's almost a teenager, or he. Oh, her, yes. Yeah, 12 these days is pretty much a teenager. Two numbers, so. Yeah. Yeah, I have a 13-year-old niece. Who I don't think she has too much anxiety and hate. But certainly she's been through some slightly rocky times. And it's tricky. I do think a person has to want to practice. You know, formal meditation at any rate. And if she thinks her mom's coming in or her dad's coming in to try and suggest things, she might take that as not being good enough. There's something wrong with her that needs to be fixed. So it's a very delicate thing. But I think you can model the loving kindness to her as a parent. If you are the parent, you might be the aunt or uncle here, or even the sister, who knows, the big sister. And just really tell them how much they're loved. You really have to tell them again and again and again and point out their qualities, point out that it's okay to feel this way, because most probably if you're the parent, you're worrying a lot. And I think, you know, it's so important for them to, as I said with Ajahn Brahm, for them to feel that you're confident they'll be okay. Try to give them that confidence. Give them lots of hugs if they will receive that. And tell them you don't expect anything from them. You don't expect them to get A grades. That's not what's going to be their success or failure in life. They've got all the time in the world to study. I actually didn't go straight for my A-levels, which was a shock to my parents because I was kind of A-grade student. And then I just kind of didn't want to do it. I was pushed too hard. I thought, why should I be pushed? I'm doing well anyway. Like, if even this isn't good enough, I might as well just give up, you know? Really. And so sometimes they feel a lot of pressure. People put pressure on themselves. You don't know what kind of peer pressure they have or pressure in school. So see if you can reduce some of that for the child. And if you can, you know, you can use kind of loving words. And they'll start to go inside for this person. You know, isn't it the case? I don't know how many people in here have sort of voices of either self-hate or just negative, tyrannical voices like, oh, you know, you really need to try harder, this isn't good enough, you never get it right. And when I trace some of the voices back that used to come up, not so much now in my mind, sometimes they come, little voices, I can see that this is the way I've been spoken to in the past, and that's why it's coming up. It's like we take it in, especially at that age, and it just comes back up like a kind of memory. When I first started meditating, you know, at 20, some people in here were meditating at 12 years old. It's amazing. Mm-hmm. I started at 20 or 19, perhaps. And the first thing I noticed was every song I'd ever heard, even unwillingly, was playing back in my mind. It was terrible. It was like I had a jukebox of like thousands of trashy songs as well as the really good stuff. And it really showed me that whatever goes in, it has to somehow come out. So try and see if you can plant some really loving thoughts and sentiments and words of encouragement to this teenager. And then just carry on with your own metta practice, and they might get interested in what you're doing. And if they start to ask, then you can tell them what you do. And if they ever want to sit with you, just have them sit there and just relax in the same room. And if they really want to start practicing metta, just give them a very simple phrase, like something like, may I be safe and well, or even maybe something more affirmative, like, I am good enough. May I know that I'm loved. Something like this. And then they can sit there with that and just talk to themselves that way from time to time. You know, you can talk to them about the mind. There's this lovely little simile that comes, I think, from the Indian tradition, like the American Indians. And it's of the good wolf and the bad wolf, that these wolves that are inside your mind and they're having a battle with each other. One of the wolves, let's say the white wolf is bad, because I don't like always saying the black wolf is bad. It's like, this makes black seem like a bad thing. So the white wolf is the bad wolf and the black wolf is the noble wolf, and they're having a kind of battle. And the child asks this Indian elder, so which wolf wins? And the elder says, the one that you feed. So see if they can feed the beautiful thoughts in their mind, and see if you can feed those thoughts for them too. And let them know these are just thoughts. You know, the suffering, the anxiety, the self-hate, these are just thoughts. They don't actually have any true reality to them. And it's normal to feel this way, especially at that sort of age. Yeah. And if it carries on and if they start to get into real depression, then see if they can talk to someone. It might be a counsellor, it might be someone at school, it could be a social worker. It's okay, you know, there's no stigma attached to that. I actually asked my parents in my teens, I think I was about 15 or 16, I was almost begging to go and talk to someone because I knew that I was really unhappy and I just wanted to be able to talk to someone about how I was feeling that wouldn't judge me. And it only took a few months of talking to someone who said, well, why don't you just change this thought into a more positive thought? Instead of, oh, there's no point trying because it will fail. What about it might not fail? You might do well. And that was all it really took, you know, just a few months. And I could see that, huh, there's a different way to look at things. And also they told me that the suffering was not all my fault. I really remember that phrase. They said, it's not all your fault. And I just hung on to that. I really hung on to that. If I could meet that woman now, she was actually just a trainee cognitive therapist, I think. I don't mean just, but, you know, she was training. And I would be so grateful to her, yeah. I just needed that little bit of input that was away from my family and it was my space. And that really helped. And then, of course, I heard the Buddha's teachings on the Four Noble Truths and I realized there was never anything wrong with me in the first place. Maybe it was wisdom, realizing that there is a lot of suffering. And there's also a way out. So that was big news. What to do when the PT arises and the mind gets very inspired, leading into lots of conceptual thinking, e.g., this is so great. I will do such and such things to save all beings, eventually leading out of the meditative state and focus. That's right, yeah, that's exactly what happens. Well, that's what happens, first of all, so don't worry. And the main thing is not to do, just to notice that this is happening and try to stay calm with it. Try to just notice, okay, this is arising due to the PT. And let me just relax. Let me just see if I can not get carried away with this thinking. And just see if you can reconnect to the peace that's there with the PT. Because PT can be a little bit agitating in this way. Especially when we're not used to it. But in a sense, it's okay because this happens in the beginning, you know, when you're not used to that kind of feeling. And it is so great, and you will do such and such things to save all beings, but just gently remind yourself that this is not the time. We'll see about that later on. For now, I'll just sit here and relax. And the other thing you can do is, it will lead out of it, and the meditative state anyway will, you know, gradually disperse, so don't worry about it. You're just getting a taste right now. It's like you're putting your toe into the PT, and that's okay. But another thing you can do at the beginning of the meditation is program your mind so that before you start sitting, you say to yourself, if PT arises, I will stay calm. If PT arises, I will stay calm. If PT arises, I will stay calm. Or something that works for you. If PT arises, I will not follow the thinking mind, or I will keep it inside, or something like this, yeah? And you just say it to yourself. Once you've established some basic mindfulness, you say it two or three times and then you let go. You continue your meditation as usual. And that might come up at that time to help break the pattern. But I think it's very normal for this to happen in the beginning. And it's great that you're getting some PT. Many people here would be really happy for you. So just watch what the mind does. Remember, meditation is far less about what you experience and far more about what you learn about the mind. We're doing this to understand the workings of our minds, and in that sense, every meditation is a success. That's why we do the little reflection at the end. We just look over the practice. What happened? Why did it happen that way? What led to calm? What didn't? What blocked it? Not to judge, but just to understand. And that way you're learning something in every single sit. So, that ends the Q&A session for tonight.